parfait.
Well, yesterday we looked at the exciting conclusion of Group B. Argentina just squeaking through, so the holders managing to hold on there, and we're going to see at least a little bit more of Diego Maradona. Today we look at Group D and Group A conclusions for each of these two, so we're going to have to fire through these games pretty rapidly. It's West Germany, Colombia to start us off, and you can see the fear of West Germany setting in at this point. Colombia pretty much decided to go all out for 0-0 early in the game. They're really, really defensive. A game that probably doesn't really suit this team when you look at the players in it. It probably helps that every team in this tournament, once they've won their first two games, come down with a serious dose of already qualified itis. They really stop going all out for it. I mean, West Germany have been so ruthless in the opening few games. Just don't seem to have that same element to them here. It doesn't take long till we get, Dave, you mentioned this, I think a couple of podcasts back when we were talking about Colombia. The cat-like description of René Higuita is out in full force early on when Klinsmann spots him off his line, tries to lob him around 20 minutes into the game. He looks like he's in trouble, but he springs back to tip it past the post, almost as if he's some sort of cat or something. The Colombians do have a couple of good chances. Valderrama sets up for Aijado for what could well be the miss of the tournament. It's an absolute shocker. Northern Irish referee Alan Snoddy has a very, very busy afternoon. He's the only Northern Irish representative at the tournament, considering they didn't qualify for this one. He pretty much gets an earful once he decides that there's an incident where Valderrama dives, and he basically waves play on. Valderrama stays down. He just doesn't call it, so he just keeps going. He refuses to even acknowledge that Valderrama's down. And annoyed by this, the Colombians then go on and just immediately smash a few German players. I think Voller is booted up in the air by Alvarez. It all eventually calms down. And this defensive plan works out relatively well for Colombia up to a point. And then disaster strikes in the 88th minute. Some great work by Voller, who's been very busy throughout the game. He rides a few tackles, gets the ball over to Litbarski, who smashes into the near post. And Colombia are heading out. And I have to say, this is one of my favourite bits. I've mentioned Barry Davis in his commentary, because I always enjoy Barry Davis on commentary for BBC. And he really, and you see this right throughout the press, actually. They're all talking about what a shame it is that Colombia are going to be out, because they've clearly enjoyed Higuita, Valderrama, and sort of the colourful and fun nature of some of the games. And at this point, Barry Davis is talking and sounds really, really disappointed that he won't get to watch them again. He mentions Valderrama particularly has been very poor. And at that exact moment, Valderrama picks up the ball around the centre circle. He sort of miscontrols it on his chest. It rolls back a couple of yards. He pivots and gets away from two German players. He then moves past the third German player, does a lovely little 1-2, drags another player towards him while Rincon, having played him the ball originally, darts to the right-hand side. Valderrama finds him, and Rincon nutmegs the goalkeeper. Barry Davis absolutely bellowing that Valderrama is alive as he finds Rincon, and Rincon scores an absolute beaut. Colombia just about salvaging one of those third-place spots now and look likely to go through. Up next, we go to Yugoslavia versus UAE. Dave, you're going to have a look at this one.
Yeah, not too dissimilar a situation, I suppose, in the sense that Yugoslavia going into the game, not a draw will be enough to bring them into the knockout stages. The only issue really is the placing, whether if they win, they can finish second and potentially first. Going into this game, there's a little bit of perhaps controversy in the sense that midfielder Sresko Katanec has ruled out the game ostensibly with a swollen knee. But it was later suggested by the manager of Vice Austin that he had in fact been pressured by Slovenian nationalists not to play in the game. That was always denied by Katanec. It's forever gone down in folklore. The game itself was quite straightforward. Yugoslavia were 2-0 up within the first 10 minutes. Susic and Pančev giving them a 2-0 halftime lead. Pančev added the second early in the second half after Juma had briefly got United Arab Emirates back in the game in the first half. And the only other thing of note was a goal deep in injury time for Robert Prozaneski, which would turn out to be quite, I suppose, iconic in later years, as he would go on to become the first player to score for two different countries in a World Cup when he netted twice for Croatia in 1998.
Yeah, very much a quiz question. Prozaneski, whenever you get those, anytime it's got something around that, he always pops up. I noticed in this game, the Italian stadiums helping in full effect, the running track around it, really helping to make the atmosphere absolutely shit, because the stadium is so empty, so empty. Elsewhere then, we've got to get back to Group A. That pretty much leaves it that Yugoslavia, Colombia, and obviously West Germany all looking likely to go through, depending on who finishes well for the third place spots. But West Germany, we know, are well clear, and Yugoslavia as well. Then in Group A, Austria face USA after their captain, Peter Hartner, got himself sent off for an outrageously stupid studs-up tackle on Peter Vermes. Peter Vermes getting involved in a lot of these, like in his team's brawls and getting kicked around the place. Maybe Hartner wanted in on that team brawl he heard about. Anyway, Andreas Ogris opens up the scoring in the second half after another boring 45 minutes of Austrian football. They catch the US on the counter. Ogris essentially runs onto a flick all on his own inside his own half. He basically has one defender to run at with no trickery or anything. He just sprints right by him and dinks beautifully over poor old Tony Miola, who seems to have had that happen to him right throughout the tournament. I've mentioned the US didn't really chase the penalty rebound against Italy. I wonder, that's at points you wonder, were they totally up on the rules or maybe just not sharp enough to it? Because in dead ball situations, they're often very prone. I mean, the Austrian player is a lion on the deck at one point. I didn't see the incident around it, just in the highlights. Austrian player lying on the deck. And there's a bit of sort of looking around as play goes on, nearly as if they're like, oh, well, we shouldn't, you know, interfere with this. Similar to the first goal, Streiter just then sprints in a straight line past the defenders, pretty much easily crossing from the byline and finds Rodax, who smashes home. The US managed to pull one back at least late on. Tab Ramos, great name. He cuts inside and left a pretty lazy-looking Austrian defender for dead. He finds Murray, who's pretty atrociously tame effort when he really should be putting it either side of the goalkeeper. He puts it directly at the goalkeeper. It essentially rolls under Lindenberger's legs and into the net. Lindenberger then sort of falling back into the net, and he goes absolutely bonkers at this point, gets himself booked about an offside, saying basically the player was offside. And, you know, he's made an absolute hash of it. He shouldn't be complaining in any capacity, but I am delighted to say that as a result we don't have to talk about Austria anymore. They win this one basically by counter-attacking a pretty naive US, pretty storyless, and that doesn't cut it when it comes to Italian 90. You can't be storyless and shit. You can be one or the other.
You mentioned deck there, that it seems like the US players aren't fully up on the rules, not just because of the fact that they tried to change them for the 94 World Cup, but a lot of the players in that US squad would have been indoor soccer players, so you know, possibly they maybe weren't completely up on the rules.
I don't think he took too many indoor soccer players, you know. I think he generally went for the outdoor because of the fact of that. But I think, as you said, they were all pretty young and naive when it came to it. They were probably indoor soccer players that had been converted to outdoor players relatively recently, you know. There's a sad little side story, just a footnote, I suppose, for the US on their way out. Despite what you'd say in this tournament, they put in an all right shift when they were massively unfancied. They got some young players to plan for the future, and they knew that they had the 94 World Cup. Bob Gansler was sacked. I'm not really sure if, again, it's sort of as time goes on, the players became more in support of him, because there's lots of incidents in this tournament that sound like they were pretty unhappy. But they do kind of sort of back him and say that it's a little bit unlucky. I mean, that he didn't hold on to his job. And really, it seems very peculiar for a guy like that to do all this work, to get a US team together, to go to a tournament like this, and his experience to be relatively discarded, not just on the national team side, but I suppose on the club team side. Because if you go to the Guardian did an oral history of the US at Italia 90, and as I said, the players are sort of praising him as a bit of a pioneer. And Bob himself says, I was never disappointed about being fired. I was more bothered that when we finally got the MLS, I wasn't one of the first 8 coaches to get his own team. So I think we've seen a little bit of that. I think oftentimes we talk about Brian Kerr and the knowledge he had here, and apart from losing the national team job, you'd like him involved in some capacity still. But it doesn't look like Bob Gansler really got that same kind of notoriety, and no one really ever thought to hold on to him. But I suppose it doesn't seem to have affected the US too bad. I know in later years we won't talk about it too much here, but you know, they did advance. They came on. You had the likes of Lalas going to Italy and stuff like that, which broke the mold, I suppose, for the US. So,
but I think they were all in Italy in 1990. But I'd say they probably, I don't know if they held that jersey against them, because you can just see the transformation between 1990, that very bland Adidas jersey, the awful jersey, really. And the whatever happened in 1994, that away kit with the stars and stripes all over it, the one that Leonardo famously got so annoyed by that he tried to break somebody's cheekbone.
Newspapers are one of the very few things that come cheap in Rome. The Eternal City is certainly cashing in on the World Cup finals. It's become rip-off city. Whether it's a restaurant, a bar, or a shop, the chances are that you'll have to pay well over the top. Taxis seem to have a supplement for just about everything. One tried to charge me an extra £3 just because he had a radio.
Let's move on to the hosts, Italy in action against Czechoslovakia. Looks like Turlock Vecini has decided to finally make a few changes. I alluded to this yesterday on the podcast. It was unlikely to happen, but here we are.
Yeah, he's made kind of the big calls that people were anticipating and hoping for. He's completely changed around the forward line. Viali, he claims, is injured, but I'm not entirely sure about that. And Carnevale, after two very underwhelming performances, has been dropped. So Italy will line up with Baggio and Schillaci up front, which, again, not so much at the start of the tournament, but Schillaci has really become a star of these early days of the tournament. And Baggio was obviously had a very vocal lobby calling for his inclusion from the start, although not necessarily as an out-and-out forward, which is an interesting call.
And also, I suppose this is a chance for those Juventus supporters to look at what their attacking lineup might well look like next season.
Indeed. In fact, people have speculated that one of the reasons Baggio was low on confidence and form, Vecini says he's been very poor in training. That's one of the reasons he hasn't picked him. But Italy had a pre-World Cup training camp in Florence, and Baggio fans turned up and then just barracked Baggio relentlessly after that very contentious move from Fiorentina to Juventus.
Do you think with Baggio, throughout his career, he seems to have had about this, because I know I'm jumping down the line here, but you look at Milan in later years and Sacchi managing him and sort of more often than not would sort of embarrass him in the press. His own player just sort of give him a bollocking. And that seems to have happened to a guy that everyone claims is this Zen Buddhist, chilled out, beautiful individual. I wonder, was he a bit of a big time Charlie for the most part? His public persona doesn't seem to have been that. And as a result, maybe his managers were just annoyed. Or is it just, as you said, he's Mr. Popular and the managers that don't pick him are then under pressure and they get fed up with it?
I've heard a lot of very conflicting things about Baggio, but I think one thing that might kind of frustrate managers is that he is so outrageously talented that you're going to get flack if you don't find a place for him in your team, even if, you know, your system isn't set up to accommodate him. And that's, you know, very kind of rigid managers tend to resent that sort of player. But anyway, he's in the side for this one. And this is actually an important game because Italy need to win to stay in Rome, which obviously they want to do. And if they're going to win, they'll have to beat Czechoslovakia for the first time in 8 attempts since 1953. So not a foregone conclusion by any means. This is actually a replay of the 1934, not literally a replay, the World Cup's not at stake, but of the 1934 World Cup final in Rome. And the Czechoslovaks have invited their 86-year-old goalkeeper from that game, Planichka, to come to the game. He's in the crowd. He's not on the bench. He's not coming.
Watch out, Peter Shilton.
Doing a Roger Miller. Italy actually hit the front very early on. It's a Doni corner out to the edge of the box. Giannini kind of mishits the shot, and then Scalacci's very alive in the box to head it on the bounce into the net. Very similar to Balint's goal for Romania the other day. I don't know if Scalacci would even have had an international career if it wasn't for Giannini's inability to shoot, because a lot of his goals seem to come from rebounds or mishits by Giannini. But yeah, that puts Italy 1-0 up after just 9 minutes. Scalacci should probably score again less than a minute later, but he can't just reach Berti's cross. He has an open goal, but he can't stretch. Italy are really hitting the high notes in the early period of the first half. They're a lot more fluid between midfield and attack than they have been. Baggio works himself into good positions for two good chances that are saved by Stejskal. He could probably score at least one of those. But yeah, at halftime, this is kind of a transformed Italy. They're much more fluid. They're much more assured than they have been in previous games. To use Damian Richardson's famous phrase, the interdepartmental choreography is up and running. They're not kind of breaking down in attack as they have been. And at halftime, they're they have a very well-deserved lead and are well on course for staying in Rome and winning the group. The Czechoslovaks start the second half very brightly. Hovanec has a shot well tipped over by Zenga. But then after 55 minutes, Scalacci is blatantly brought down in the box by Thomas Skoradi. And inexplicably, there's no penalty. It's even a two-footed challenge. I honestly don't know how that one was missed. But Italy's pressure continues unabated. Stejskal is more or less playing them single-handedly. Giannini does manage to beat him, but Hasek chases back to clear it off the line. But then there's a serious scare for Italy when, again, the officials not covering themselves in glory in this game. Mrafčík plays a ball in from the left. It's headed on, and Griga thumps it past Zenga from close range. Absolutely nothing wrong with this goal whatsoever. I've watched it back from multiple angles, multiple times. It's one of those where I honestly don't know why it's been disallowed, even allowing for the fact that the call was clearly wrong. I don't know what the call was. It's not offside. There's no foul. There's no handball. Bizarre decision. Mrafčík claimed in later years it was because FIFA wanted Italy to stay in Rome and they were micromanaging the referees, which not an outlandish claim when it comes to Italian football, but I don't think that's what's happened on this occasion.
And probably not an outlandish claim when it comes to World Cup football, because we can probably find many other instances where you would say the hosts have gotten the rub of the green, but I suppose that generally happens when you're the host.
Yeah, I remember a Copa America a few years later in Bolivia, where the tournament was set up for ideally a Brazil-Bolivia final, which would obviously recoup all the investment. And the tournament organizer, using a very unfortunate turn of phrase, said it all worked out exactly as we planned it. but that's Mrafčík's theory, and he's sticking to it. But anyway, it's all academic after 78 minutes, because this is where Baggio really announces himself on the World Cup stage. He picks the ball up 40 yards out on the left. He beats a fairly half-hearted challenge from Hasek, drives towards goal. Kadlec commits. He turns him inside out with a body swerve and then takes the shot earlier than Stejskal is expecting, and kind of clips it near post as Stejskal goes to the right. Keeper goes a bit early for me, Clive. It's probably the first really impressive solo goal of the World Cup. The crowd goes absolutely mental. This is exactly what everyone was hoping for and expecting from Baggio. That's a triumphant way for Italy to finish out their group phase and win the group, stay in Rome, and integrate Baggio into a team that's beginning to take shape and seems to have got on top of those scoring difficulties and difficulties up front that had beset them before the tournament. So it finishes Italy 2, Czechoslovakia 0.
Vecini absolutely furious that his sort of enigmatic substitute comes on and scores such a goal and wins, and not exactly wins in the game, but confirms the win. And as you said, if Scalacci's was a sort of standard Scalacci goal that we seem to see time and time again, you would probably say similar to Baggio's, which you would recreate time and time again, this sort of beautifully drifting pass, whoever's in his way, and slotting home. Like if he had a special move, that would be exactly what's happened there. You know, if you could just build a Baggio goal, that's exactly what we'd know and look for. Let's get on then to what's happening elsewhere in the press. Let's check in with the Irish camp. It's I'd say it's getting a little bit tense now with this game coming up. And you know, we talked about the fallout of the Egypt game continuing. I imagine this, you know, more and more opinion pieces and everyone getting involved, having their two cents.
Yeah, it's already a bit tiresome. It's really all about the recriminations from the Egypt game rather than necessarily looking forward to the Dutch game. On Kerry County Council, Councillor PJ Cronin has called for Minister Ray Burke to have Eamon Dunphy taken off the air. and he dubs him a traitor in a very, very, very intemperate contribution to a county council meeting. The Cronins would be kind of to the Healy Rays as a political dynasty in Kerry, that his son is still a councillor, you'll be astonished to learn.
You wouldn't get that kind of outlandish statement being made in Kerry these days. Like,
yeah, unfortunately, it's in the DNA of the political class. In terms of the Netherlands game, Ireland are seriously looking at changes to to, I suppose, to maybe give themselves more attacking options and to also counter the threat of the Dutch, I suppose, the three Milan players, especially with the Dutch side, although they, none of them have been particularly impressive. So in training today, Ireland trial a kind of a 3-5-2 formation with David O'Leary coming in as a sweeper alongside Mick McCarthy and Kevin Moran. By all accounts, it's an absolute disaster. It doesn't work at all. They get hammered by the likes of Bernie Slaven and John Byrne. So God knows what Van Basten is going to do to them. So it's very quickly abandoned. But the other speculation is that Niall Quinn might well come in for Tony Cascarino. Quinn, by all accounts, has been in excellent form in training. Cascarino has looked really short on confidence in the first two games he's played. So, yeah, nerves are beginning to jangle, but it does look somewhat likely that we will see some kind of change ahead of the Netherlands game.
Any Ronnie Whelan news?
Everyone's given up on Ronnie Whelan, but believe it or not, he is tentatively coming back to fitness and he might just feature on the bench. We're not sure yet, but it does look as though Charlton's got over his exasperation with Ronnie's briefing to the press and he might play some role in the Dutch game.
The biggest slap in the face possible from Charlton that he to take all the calls for Ronnie to put in at left back and goes and decides to go with three at the back instead.
Do you think that three at the back is just pretty much derided from the fact that England switched to it and it worked pretty well against Netherlands?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think Charlton said as much, actually. They thought that was very effective for the English against the Dutch, and it was more just, I suppose, Charlton showing a bit more flexibility as a tactician than he'd have a reputation for, but I think the experiment lasts like half an hour, so his patience obviously isn't matching.
Didn't have a Bernie Slaven or a John Byrne?
Well, there was speculation that Bernie Slaven might come in, which seems unbelievable to me for Aldridge, because Bernie Slaven, not a player anyone under 30 has probably ever heard of, unless they're familiar with him as a pundit. But yeah, he's considered a viable option for that Aldridge slot.
Mind you, with how poorly Aldridge is playing, I mean, you could nearly have anyone in form at this point, and you're probably running out of options. Well, I suppose elsewhere then, we don't really have a whole lot to cover. I think, Dave, you pointed out the sort of news about, I suppose, a couple of days after the Soviet Union pretty much exit this tournament, the Communist Party of the Russian Soviet Federation Socialist Republic is founded in Moscow.
A vaguely interesting story from Ireland, where there's sort of speculation that there might be an Italian 90 baby boom, and it might well be needed to keep up Ireland's famously fertile birth rate, because the Irish birth rate has shrunk. And statistics from the Department of Social Welfare show there are now only 55 families in Ireland with 12 or more kids, and only one with 16 kids.
Tomorrow then, we look ahead to the conclusion of Group C. We'll see Brazil in action, Scotland in desperate need of a result, and Sweden, Costa Rica.
Father Rama, who served his side poorly on this occasion, suddenly he's alive. This is Rincon! And he's gone! Unbelievable! Unbelievable!